Brought out later in the congressional investigation of the IPR, John D. Rockefeller III participated in the activities of Edward C. Carter, IPR secretary, in a hideaway disguised as a barn at Lee, Massachusetts. It was there that the groundwork was laid for engineering the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. The existence of the Germany-Italy-Japan axis meant that we would automatically be at war with Germany, which was menacing Britain as soon as we were attacked by Japan. Once Churchill and the British saw after Dunkirk that they were doomed without American help, a deal was made to open up the Saudi Arabian oil concessions to the Rockefellers. The Pearl Harbor disaster was then arranged in order to galvanize Americans into support for going into war. Needed defenses were denied to the naval commanders at Pearl Harbor. The American warships at Pearl Harbor were all brought in and bottled up within the harbor like sitting ducks, in spite of growing tensions with Japan and even rumors of imminent attack. Finally, when the attack itself came, advance warnings from several sources were all ignored, suppressed in Washington. The actual day and hour of attack was known to President Roosevelt and his boss, Nelson Rockefeller, 1 week ahead of time, and nothing was done but to sit tight and make sure that the Pearl Harbor attack occurred as planned. As World War II came on, Nelson Rockefeller maneuvered Roosevelt through war preparations at home. He dictated the passage of a universal military training bill and the drafting of our youth to serve the Rockefeller cause at taxpayer expense in the forthcoming war. This done, he himself promptly evaded the draft, ordering that he be appointed coordinator of hemispheric defense, as far away as possible from the war front in Latin America. He also arranged to have Roosevelt demand and obtain an appropriation of $6 billion from Congress to use for his so-called coordination. With this money, he began to flood Latin America and Cuba with communist agents to drive out proprietors and property owners, leaving the Rockefeller dynasty in virtually complete control of Latin America. Saudi Arabian oil fields were brought into production at no cost to the Rockefeller Exxon crowd, entirely at taxpayer expense and a cost of more than half a million GIs' lives. Saudi Arabian oil cost the Rockefeller interests only 5 cents a barrel for a period of 30 years, preceding the Arab oil boycott recently. Since domestic oil cost them in the range of from $1 to several dollars per barrel, they steadily cut down on production and purchase of oil in the United States, despite its actual abundance. This forced many independent oil companies out of business, garnered fantastic profits for themselves, which they used to rapidly take over additional major industries here and abroad, and made us increasingly dependent on foreign oil. Thus, they laid the basis for our present so-called energy crisis, which they have also taken advantage of to raise fuel and other prices with and without government help. After the deal with Churchill was arranged by the Rockefellers to drag the United States into World War II, Nelson Rockefeller's activities at the top of the federal government steadily accelerated. He personally lobbied through Congress an endless array of programs which were sold as necessary for national defense and security and the like, but which were actually for the purpose of draining off our national wealth into Rockefeller coffers as rapidly as possible. Lend-Lease, for example, was used, among other things, to help build up the military and economic strength of the Soviet Union as part of the price for the Rockefellers to retain their control of the vast Baku oil fields in Russia. The concessions to these had been obtained by the Rockefellers in 1926, granted to them by Stalin as repayment for the Rockefeller role in the Russian Revolution in 1917. You probably remember from your high school history book that the Russian Revolution was financed from outside Russia. What is not usually mentioned, however, is that the Rockefeller dynasty was the source of that financing. Thus, an alliance between the Russian communists and the Rockefeller Empire was forged, which has persisted down to the present day. Foreign aid, beginning with the so-called Marshall Plan and continuing with the Point 4 program and so forth, was the object of particular enthusiasm on the part of Nelson Rockefeller, who championed them in every possible form throughout the country. And no wonder. As early as December 1948, only months after the Marshall Plan got underway, the Chicago Tribune published an editorial based on Marshall Plan records which proved that the majority of foreign aid funds were cleverly channeled into the pockets of the Rockefellers through accounting devices of their multinational oil companies. But the various bills lobbied through their Congress by Nelson Rockefeller and his aides to require most foreign aid monies to go to certain Americans for overseas development purposes remained intact, and looting of foreign aid funds by the Rockefellers has never been stopped. Over the years, foreign aid has extracted mountains of money from American pockets. And it is no coincidence that the rise of American-based multinational corporations has coincided with the era of ever-expanding foreign aid. These multinationals, with their unique tax advantages, multiple citizenship, and access to foreign aid funds, among other things, were initially a product of the growing worldwide power of the Rockefeller dynasty, but have long since become a primary means by which that very power is growing by leaps and bounds. In my book, The Conspiracy Against the Dollar, I have explained in detail how the huge multinationals controlled by the Rockefellers were used in 1971 and 1972 to start the United States dollar on the road toward complete destruction, a process that is now entering the final critical stages. Yes, it's Nelson Rockefeller playing the role of the inside man within our government, who has been able, in concert with his powerful brothers, to bring the United States economy and with it freedom to the brink of destruction. And it is he who will offer himself as our national savior as he pushes us off the edge. A new constitution, so-called, has been written over a 10-year period with Rockefeller backing and now stands ready for introduction as soon as Nelson Rockefeller is in a position to do so. The people who have written it have done so as usual under the aegis of a tax-exempt Rockefeller philanthropy with the misleading name Center for Study of Democratic Institutions. The people most central to the writing of this document, which is an elaborate prescription for dictatorship, were also associated with Rockefeller in the writing of a proposed world constitution and setting up the United Nations. The United Nations was organized in its present form at the United Nations Organizations Conference in San Francisco in 1945, where Nelson Rockefeller represented President Roosevelt as advisor to the U.S. delegation. The completeness of Nelson Rockefeller's grip on this proceeding was expressed by Senator Vandenberg, a member of the delegation, who frankly declared to the press, quote, "Anything Rockefeller wants is okay," unquote. What he wanted is clear from what he did. First, he arranged with the Soviets to have his most intimate and trusted associate, Alger Hiss, appointed as Secretary General of the conference. Next, he arranged to have the World Constitution drawn up to embody his ideas, presented as the UN Charter. This was gleefully accepted by the Soviets, who were particularly delighted by two of its facets. First, it in effect replaced the United States Constitution, since provisions of the UN Charter are always to be followed wherever there is any conflict. Because of this, treason against the United States of America, which is clearly defined in our Constitution, has ceased to be considered a crime or therefore punishable. This is why Nelson's brother, John D. III, for example, was immune from punishment even though his treason in connection with Pearl Harbor was established in congressional investigations. This is why Ramsey Clark, Jane Fonda, and other Americans who went to Hanoi in the midst of the Vietnam War and gave aid and comfort to the enemy were immune from punishment. Even Alger Hiss, caught in his treasonous activities on behalf of Nelson Rockefeller by Richard Nixon, could not be convicted of treason. Hiss was convicted merely of perjury in connection with treason, which is equivalent to saying that treason is okay, but lying about it is the only crime. The second provision of the UN Charter, offered by Nelson Rockefeller and adopted by the conference, was the establishment of a UN Military Affairs Committee, to which all member nations must report in advance any contemplated military action in full detail. The Soviets, of course, were overjoyed with this because of a collateral agreement which was also made, namely, that the chairman of the UN Military Affairs Committee must always be a Soviet general. This agreement has been carried out to the letter now for 30 years. Thus, Nelson Rockefeller guaranteed that the United States would never again win an armed conflict. The outcomes of Korea and Vietnam were thus foregone conclusions as soon as they started. Tens of thousands of American GIs would be killed, hundreds of thousands would be wounded, many of them maimed for life. Billions of dollars would be siphoned out of American pockets and into those of the Rockefeller interests and allies, and the self-confidence of the American people would be undermined. The Rockefellers were so pleased with the United Nations that they donated the property for it, its permanent headquarters in New York City. During the Eisenhower regime, Nelson Rockefeller blossomed out in all his glory. Eisenhower was grateful to the Rockefellers for giving him the presidency, particularly Nelson Rockefeller's uncle, Winthrop Aldrich, who made it very attractive for a large proportion of Senator Robert Taft's delegation at the Republican Convention in 1952 to switch to Eisenhower. Ike's first act after inauguration was to give Nelson Rockefeller a free hand in reorganizing the executive branch of the government. Rockefeller moved with his entourage to his estate at 2500 Fox Hall Road in Washington, from which he ran the government, while Ike went around the country building his reputation as a golfer. The only portion of the executive branch that really aroused Nelson Rockefeller's enthusiasm, however, was the military, which he promptly recycled under one roof. Having made sure through the UN and other means that America's ability to truly defend itself was at an end, he named the reorganized military complex the Defense Department. He made its prime function to sell munitions and military hardware around the world and put at the head of each division the top salesman in his field. Their job is to sell ever more of the dynasty's war material, using field demonstrations, minor conflicts, and even wars to help sell them. It is a competitive effort among the several military branches, with rewards going to the most successful. And so it is, my friends, that you have probably noticed a major shift in the way our weapon systems are developed and marketed over the past 25 years. It used to be that America developed the best possible weapons for America, and for the most part sold them off to other nations only as they were replaced by newer and better ones for our own use. But nowadays, the first consideration for a new warplane, for example, is to beat the bushes around the world to see how many other countries we can sell them to, even while the warplane itself is still on the drawing board. Needless to say, this leaves us without any real secrets in many areas of our so-called defense. But it does make a lot of money for Nelson Rockefeller and the rest of his dynasty, which controls the major manufacturers of armaments in America and abroad. In the late 1950s, Nelson Rockefeller decided the time had come at last to run for elective office. His decision essentially coincided with the adoption in New York State of mechanical voting machines made by the Automatic Voting Machine Company of Jamestown, New York. This company had been purchased and merged into the Rockefeller-dominated Rockwell Manufacturing Company. Rumors were widespread that they were fixable and facilitated the stealing of elections. But these suggestions were ridiculed by some who proclaimed themselves to be authorities. In any case, Nelson Rockefeller, New Deal Democrat, resolved to enter the race for governor of New York State as a Republican, since the Democrats were committed to nominating someone else, Averell Harriman. He was welcomed into the Republican Party without difficulty and easily became the nominee. After winning the election handsomely, I may say, he promptly took full control of the Automatic Voting Machine Company by buying up stock from minority stockholders at $20 per share, five times the market price of $4 a share. Of course, there was no suggestion that this reflected his evaluation of the role the machines played in his election. Several years later, in the early 1960s, a great hue and cry arose in Louisiana about the stealing of elections by means of a different machine in use there, the Shoup voting machine. Finally, the legislature was forced to act. On the basis of a concurrent resolution, the legislature staged a demonstration of the various voting machines used in the United States. Former employees of the companies demonstrated the ease with which such machines could be fixed to steal elections. In the course of the demonstration, it was shown that the Shoup machine could be more easily fixed, and in more ways than any other for the purpose of election stealing. Very shortly thereafter, New York State, whose governor was now Nelson Rockefeller, ordered the disposal of their automatic voting machines at sacrifice prices, and their replacement with Shoup machines. Control of the Shoup voting machine company was also purchased, passed through a number of obscure transfers, which Dunn and Bradstreet had difficulty in following, and reportedly ended up, when last checked, an obscure subsidiary of what is now known as Exxon. The Rockefeller control of Exxon is, of course, well known. Thereafter, Nelson Rockefeller had no difficulty in being reelected time and again, despite his growing unpopularity in New York State. While governor, he increased New York State taxes more than 500%. He increased the state debt more than 300%. He launched massive spending projects, such as the Mammoth Albany Mall project, to house government offices by devious financial schemes put together by clever advisors such as John Mitchell, so as to circumvent voter desires, and refused to be disturbed by minor matters like 3-to-1 cost overruns and functional unsuitability of some of these projects. He drove numerous industries out of New York State by confiscatory taxation as he catered to soaring union and welfare demands. Indeed, the Rockefellers themselves all but shut down their Exxon offices in New York about 4 years ago, transferring 3,000 employees to Houston, Texas, and 1,000 of them to Hong Kong. Altogether, Nelson Rockefeller succeeded during his years as governor in vastly increasing the number of unemployed and those on welfare rolls. Now, having honed his abilities in every possible form, Nelson Rockefeller is at last nearing success in the goal he has sought for decades, to become the openly acknowledged ruler of the United States and to use our country as the springboard for a final conquest of the entire world for the Rockefeller dynasty. He created the 25th Amendment by which he and Gerald Ford have come to office without submitting themselves to a vote of the people. He had his agent, Senator Birch Bayh, propose this scheme only 3 weeks after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and had Senator Bayh push it successfully through the Congress. He then had Herbert Brownell move the 25th Amendment through the states to ratification in unusually short time, in 2 months' time, by the way, by 1967. The stage was then set for the downfall of President Nixon when the time was ripe several years later. The Watergate scandal was masterminded by Nelson Rockefeller and carried out by his private detective agency, the CIA, including the breaking of the story in the Washington Post by CIA agents posing as reporters. My friends, the things I have just told you about are shocking, brutal, and frankly unbelievable at first hearing. But I warn you, please do not dismiss them out of hand simply because of their awesome nature. These things are the truth, and they merely give you an idea of what is coming soon if Nelson Rockefeller, working in concert with his brothers David, Lawrence, and John D. III, is allowed to succeed in his dictatorial plans. The first step in stopping this madness is for you, the American citizen, to realize what is happening. Hitler achieved his post by legal means as set up in the Constitution of the Weimar Republic. He was appointed Chancellor of the Reich by aging President von Hindenburg January 30, 1933. And remember, President Ford, on August 20, 1974, appointed Nelson Rockefeller as his vice president. The German citizens who watched Adolf Hitler maneuver his way to power in many cases simply could not believe their eyes and preferred to hope out of blind optimism that things would not deteriorate completely. They suffered horribly for failing to observe, to grasp the truth, and to act. Please, my friends, let us not allow this to happen in America. Until next month, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.